Hi, this is Past, Present and Future, and I'm Russell Hearn. Today I have the pleasure of talking to one of EMDR UK's trainers, consultants and authors. He's a man who's brought his own unique flair to training events in this country and overseas, as well as the UK Association website. No mean feat, let me tell you. He's the new president-elect, and it's my great pleasure to introduce Matt Wesson. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Russ. Great to be here.
Thank you. It's lovely to have you. We like to go through people's journey into EMDR in this program. I know you served for many years in the armed forces, and I wondered what prompted that switch from combat conditions to the therapy room.
Well, I joined the military when I was 19 as a weapons engineer, of all things. I don't quite know why. That didn't really interest me, but I just wanted to join the forces. And that happened to be a job that the careers office were looking for at that time. But after a couple of years of doing that, I had quite a bad accident where I shattered my right arm. And during that rehab period, it gave me a chance to reflect and think about where I wanted to go next. I found out that there was a small mental health branch within the Royal Navy where I was serving. I made some inquiries, found out you could transfer, passed the interview, and the rest, they say, is history. And it was quite soon into that career that I found out about EMDR therapy. I think I was the second ever person in the MOD to train in it, definitely the second uniform person back in 1999. And it was just great during that period of kind of 20 years in the military to see EMDR therapy grow within defense and help, you know, thousands of military.
I'm sure, people, yeah. So. I was just thinking, you said that was sort of back at the turn of the century, and the few sort of military vets that I've worked with, I've always spoke about the difficulty in discussing mental health for them, the stigma that's associated with it. And I wonder what kind of barriers you came up against when you were originally training.
I think with the Defence Mental Health Services, we see the end products, really. In a way, you don't know what you don't know. There may have been many, and I predict many thousands of people that were struggling, but unless they would go to their GP or their chaplain and they would make the referral, then we wouldn't see them. But we were acutely aware, certainly from Optelec, so 2003 with the Iraq conflicts and beyond, that there was an active campaign to reduce stigma that was often outside of mental health and the medical services, trying to reduce stigma across the board so that we could treat people and help them, because ultimately if they don't present, we can't do anything. So we're acutely aware, I think, of the tongue-in-cheek view when I would explain to colleagues that maybe in the sports scene or outside of medicine and mental health, they would have certain comical views about mental health. That definitely changed to a more positive outlook by the time sort of I completed my career, which is a really positive thing. Mm. But still work to be done, I would say.
And I know you're still very much involved with service personnel now, helping them through their traumas. What is it about EMDR that you think that makes it so powerful with that client group?
There was a colleague of mine, Jamie Hacker-Hughes, also an EMDR consultant, talked about it really fits with the warrior mentality. And I really like that statement, because it's not a talking therapy, as we know. It's an experiential therapy. And stereotypically, this client's don't really want to talk in depth. They don't want to have necessarily existential discussions about things. They often know that they're broken, if you like, and they want to be fixed or healed. So it's a model that works. There's lots of other advantages as well. Obviously, a lot of trauma is held somatically. That's often an aspect that veterans would kind of know things but feel differently to that. So we know that's an aspect of EMDR. Another huge aspect, particularly compared to trauma-focused CBT, is there's no homework. And homework never seems to go down well with service personnel. I read once an article. It was about mindfulness-based stress reduction and that they'd done a trial of this for people pre-deployment in America. But there was a great quote where they asked one of the veterans about their thoughts, and basically was, whatever you do, don't mess with my time off. Because he was asked to attend this study in his downtime. And that's the kind of work hard, play hard mentality is still there. We're away a lot. People are away a lot. And the last thing they want is when they go home is to do more work, to write a trauma account or, you know, to keep diaries. So the fact, I think, that EMDR, they turn up, they work very hard during that session, and then they go away, look after themselves, come back next week. Very much fits with that kind of work hard, play hard mentality. Or as often was said, you train hard, you fight easy. So they come in and work hard during those sessions and then they go away. So lots of avenues that make it a really effective treatment, which is why it's particularly disappointing that NICE made that caveat. Maybe we'll talk about that later. Not sure, Russ.
Okay. I can talk about it now if you wish.
Well, I mean, most people, we know how NICE recommendations lead a lot of how mental health is delivered, particularly in the NHS. And in the rewrite in 2018, there was this caveat that it said EMDR, not for veterans, for most other people as a first-line treatment alongside trauma-focused CBT. And they claimed that was because of the lack of evidence, which I agree, there is a lack of evidence. However, there's some politics in that. Nearly all the evidence for combat-related PTSD is produced by the states and by the Department of Defense, and they seem to only fund trauma-focused CBT trials. So, of course, you create a bias very quickly. Mm. So there's a difference between a lack of evidence and a lack of effectiveness. But that's where we're at. I think all we can do at the moment is try and generate more evidence. It's particularly difficult with military personnel and veterans. They're a difficult group to pin down, difficult group to get access to. But that's what we have to do. We have to remember that NICE is a guideline. We can still use our clinical judgment. And that's what I would still do when I have veterans. I use a clinical judgment, which is often that I think this is a great model. I'm also trained in trauma-focused CBT and I've never really had the same results with those. So disappointing, but we can respond to it. And we can also remember we've still got our clinical judgment.
Mm. I love that sort of quote that you said, that EMDR for the service personnel was fitted in with that warrior mentality. But then I also imagined that when the session ended, they went home for some R&R. And I think that was a great kind of analogy. So when therapy is not going quite as planned with some clients, what's that the case that's in the back of your mind, the one that you kind of remember and restores your confidence in what you're doing in the use of EMDR?
I think there's a few, but because I'm training a lot, not at the moment, but usually most weeks I'm training somewhere. And within our training, we always show real clinical videos. So these are my clients that have very graciously and courageously allowed me to show their sessions, as long as, you know, we keep confidentiality and I explain all of that. I see them week in, week out, and they still touch me sometimes when I talk about them. I get still quite emotional. So being able to see that, I think, restores that. I've always been passionate about psychotherapy. And even now as a trainer and a consultant, I still try and see clients every week, try and do EMDR therapy every week. And so that restores your confidence. I think if I was only teaching it, then the danger is you come across as this ivory tower approach, or you start to lose faith in it because it's been a while since you've done it. So I think the videos that I show on the training, but my clients week in, week out, I learn from them, I learn about the model. But I also remember that it's not the only thing I use EMDR therapy. There's other things in my toolbox, and none of them go exactly to plan at any point. Psychotherapy is a complex model. Humans are complex. So I do try and remember that, you know, supervision helps monitor my unrelenting high standards, that, you know, things don't always go to plan, but most of the time they do. And when it works, it's still the model that gets me the most excited, the most passionate, because when it is working well, it is just a pleasure to be in the company of a client that is adaptively processing, making links, and also is courageous and trusting enough to work together with me. So all of those things, I think, helped me keep my passion for EMDR and for psychotherapy.
It's always nice to hear a trainer say it doesn't go perfectly every time, which I think is reassuring for most people. You did mention seeing your clients on video, which I thought was lovely. And I was just thinking as you said that, you know, we have to produce and show videos for accreditation purposes. But do you think it's important to get into a routine of using video in our practice so that we can continually reflect on what we're doing?
Absolutely. It's something I'm hugely passionate about, but it's still something personally that I find difficult. So the other main model that I'm trained in is CBT. So I'm an accredited CBT therapist. And the potential advantage of that, it's very much embedded in CBT that you record your work regularly. It's actually part of the accreditation. To re-accredit, I have to show that I'm regularly showing live extracts of sections of sessions or whole sessions and getting them rated by a supervisor. So I've been in kind of role modeled into that way of working. And it's actually a way I do think EMDR can learn from cognitive therapy, because whenever a supervisee does play an extract, there's such a richness in that experience. I understand so much more as a supervisor, and the supervisee, when they listen back to it, they nearly always answer their own questions. They supervise themselves. So I encourage it for everybody, from those who are just beginning all the way to kind of consultants and trainers, that we still do that. We still record our work with consent, because there is so much richness in that data that you do miss if it's a second-hand account of that process. Yeah. And I'm always hugely surprised about how willing clients are. As long as you explain it, that it's in part of your learning and development, there's very few that have said no. There's some technical issues about where you store that and make it really secure, but actually clients are usually very willing to help us keep improving our own practice. So I'm hugely passionate about that.
The great thing about working online now is that it's a click of a button once you've got consent.
Absolutely. There's really no excuse apart from a client saying, I don't want you to do that. Obviously, we have to get explicit consent. But my experience is most clients do consent to that, at least an audio recording. And still, sometimes it's not as good as a video. And I know we need video for accreditation. But even audio recordings that I've used with supervisees, there's still a richness of data in that. If I listen to somebody's phase three and an audio recording, we can usually pick that apart for about an hour of the things that are great, where we can learn. And like you said, Russ, I never expect in my own work or other people's perfection, but it's about an awareness of where we're straying, where we could maybe improve, where we've really adapted really well and what we can learn from that. So, yeah, it's much easier nowadays, I would say.
So we were talking about training there. I guess, you know, we've had a bit of a hiccup in training that it was suspended because of COVID. I'm now understand that we've got the green light to go ahead with some form of training in the future. What do you think will be the greatest challenges for that?
Yeah, it's been a difficult time. I love training. I love supervision. I love my client work. But the training side has been a huge challenge from this, trying to run a training organization in amongst the pandemic. It's been a challenge. So we've got an amber light, I would say, not a green light. So we can do some training online, which is for those who have already started. We can do some components of that online, as long as we repeat some of the practical components later on. So didactic teaching is easy to do online. It's the practicals. But actually, there's platforms like Zoom. There are others available where you can do these breakout rooms where people go off into separate kind of virtual rooms and can work in pairs or triads, and they can have a facilitator watching that. So it's all possible, but it's just like online EMDR. It's a mind shift. As long as you make that mind shift, it's more than possible. So yeah, we can do that. It's going to require an adaptation for all the trainers and facilitators and the delegates for those who've started. Why it's an amber light is currently EMDR Europe, so we can't do that for people new to EMDR therapy. So those who, say, the middle of March, where when all this stopped, were due to start their part one, nowhere in Europe have they been able to start. And that will be thousands of potential EMDR therapists. So when social restrictions get reduced, or if EMDR Europe reconsider their position, the first thing we'll do is have a big backlog. So that's a real challenge, because we are, unfortunately, having to turn down clinicians, mainly NHS clinicians, some with specific COVID budgets that they want to put into training, and say, I'm sorry, we're not allowed to train you. So my personal opinion is that's a bit of an own goal. It doesn't really fit with our articles as an association about the relief of suffering. But it's a decision EMDR Europe have made. We asked them to reconsider it. But as an EMDR Europe accredited training provider, like my colleagues in the UK, if they say it, that's what we have to do for now. But the good news is we can continue training. Hopefully we can start with those who want to begin their EMDR career soon.
Yeah. And I imagine once COVID has blown its way through the world and we're out the other side, I imagine that online EMDR will be part of future trainings. It just seems as it will be embedded in the future.
Well, certainly, yeah, online EMDR, I think hopefully will be. It was a question that would always come up in training. And actually, personally, I'd say, I know people do it, but I'd never done it. Obviously, I have now, and I've been really pleasantly surprised. I don't think the training will be allowed to continue online, because I think there's some strong views that it's better and should all be done in person where it can. I'm not saying I necessarily completely agree with that, but I do think there's a richness of being face-to-face with people in person. But certainly online EMDR, I think, is with us now forever, hopefully, because it will allow more people to access EMDR therapy, because some people can't travel to clinics or don't want to or prefer this way of working. So I think, yeah, post-pandemic, we'll have a choice. We'll be able to offer in-person EMDR and online EMDR. And I think they both have really good positives and both have some setbacks as well. But in the hands of a good EMDR therapist, they can navigate those.
If we just move from kind of the present to the future, think about some of the things that are coming up. I know you've worked so hard on revamping the website, which is looking amazing. So thank you for all the effort that's gone into that. Are there any other plans around the website to kind of improve its functionality, the way it can support members?
We're going through, hopefully, a consolidation phase. So with your help, Russ, we finalized the animations. That was really the last piece of the puzzle, that when we designed the website, that's we always had a view about the animations being a key part of that. So I think at the moment we're going to go through a consolidation phase. Although even during that, there's been new aspects added to it. So we've got resources for clients and therapists about online EMDR and about COVID-19. We've added a section for association news where these podcasts are going to sit, where other information, the EMDR Therapy Quarterly, will sit there. So we will tweak it constantly. But I'm acutely aware that if we just add things all the time, sometimes you lose the essence of a clean, easily navigatable site. So I think every time we need to consider what you gain and what you lose by adding information. But you're right about engaging members, engaging the public, engaging the media. That's always our remit. So I think if we can think of ways that we can improve on that, that would be fantastic. We talked the other day in one of the meetings with the board about potentially making an area somewhere, whether it's on the website, where people can access a library of EMDR articles. Now we have the Francine Shapiro Library, but it's not always the easiest to work around. But that's a common question that people certainly within, for example, the NHS may say, what is the evidence base for EMDR and chronic pain? If we could maybe eventually, it will be a long project, have a place where they could go for those resources and answer questions quickly. I think that's an avenue that we'll look into. But yeah, I think it's important we also have a consolidation phase. But one plan, maybe in between those two points of consolidation and a long-term plan of maybe a repository, is that accreditation, all the paperwork can be submitted online. We're already moving to membership renewals being all done online. So it's making as much slicker, automated online, because we have a growing membership, which is fantastic, but we're struggling to keep up with that, the accreditation committee and other aspects. So anything we can make slicker, if we can use the website for that, I think that would be a great thing.
Sounds good. And as president-elect, hopes for the future, have you got kind of aims?
Well, I listened to the first podcast that Mike delivered as president. I did say that was a tough act to follow. But what's really great is a lot of the things that Mike talked about, I'm also passionate about. So he talked about professionalizing the organization. I do think we need to use some of our resources to bring in external support, maybe with administration, maybe with research. And the big issue being research as well, that where we can use our resources and expertise within the board and the membership to facilitate more research into EMDR. I think people have been saying that for many years. NICE 2018 for PTSD was finally the rude awakening, I think, that we needed to say, if we don't up our game, if we don't start delivering, whether you like it or not, randomized controlled trials, because they seem to be the gold currency that you need. Unless we do that, we're going to lag further and further behind, mainly CBT, that's kind of overtaking the world. So that's a thing I'm passionate about, facilitating or encouraging people to do research, maybe trying to get funding for that. And the last aspect, again, that I think Mike talked about is engaging the membership. I think it's something with the website and through this pandemic, we've really tried to reach out to the membership, because what I've learned is being on the board is the membership as well. We're not different. We are members. We've just members that have volunteered to give our time to support the association. So I don't want it to feel like there's the board over there, there's the members over here. They are one thing. So I would ask that, yeah, anything we can do to engage the membership, but also ask the membership to, wherever possible, for them to step up. If they have a skill, if they have resources, that they offer them to the broader membership. And it's been great to see that happen through the pandemic already. I'd really, really like that to continue, that we join together instead of separate, which sometimes has happened with arguments about protocols and ways of working. It's sometimes felt a bit splintered. I'm hoping this, like maybe the whole world, will be a healing process, that we can come together, because we have bigger fights to fight, and that is keeping our position in the psychotherapy world.
Brilliant. That's lovely, Matt. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
No, it's been a real pleasure. Great questions. And yeah, it's been a real fun to talk it through.
Past, Present and Future is a Laura Beach production for EMDR UK.